United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Leo M. Gordon presiding before Court Number 15-00135, Kent International, Inc. versus the United States. Will the attorneys please state their names and firm for the record, starting with plaintiff's counsel.
Patrick Reed of Simons & Miskin, appearing for the plaintiff, Kent International.
Monica Triana on behalf of the United States. Yelena Slipak on behalf of CBP.
Okay. All righty. Mr. Reed, you're prepared to proceed?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
You may approach the podium. You may proceed. Stop right there, Mr. Reed. Your primary argument is Kent has established or made its claim for treatment based upon its own entries, correct? And I don't reach your third point, third parties, unless your first argument fails, correct? Okay, proceed. Regulation has a three-prong test, correct? 177.12, right? And you are saying that there's no dispute between the parties as to prongs one and two, right? That there were governmental, there were CBP decisions or determinations that were made, and those decisions were made by a responsible CBP official, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and so that... Yeah, Mr. Reed, if you can, pull the mic a little closer to you and just project a little more, that would be helpful for the audio transcript, okay?
Okay, I think
that's excellent. All right, and so we are here to discuss whether Kent has satisfied the third prong, which is substantially identical transactions on a national basis, correct?
Right.
Okay.
And I understand that the issue is whether they were on a national basis.
Correct.
And Kent satisfies that requirement because no customs office.
So there's no dispute in your mind, leastwise with respect to Kent's transactions, that you satisfied that part of the third prong, substantially identical transactions, no issue with respect to Kent's transactions, correct?
As far as I know, that the government has never raised that issue.
Right.
All of the.
But if we get to your third argument, which is about third parties, then there may be a
come
question
back to
there.
Substantially identical. Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Continue, please.
So national basis requirement is satisfied because no customs office anywhere in the United States between 2008 and 2010 made any actual determination reaching a different classification. And the drafting history of the regulation explains that the national basis requirement is intended, quote, to ensure that a treatment does not result from a geographically narrow application of a determination that is different from the action taken by customs at other locations. Here, there was no determination during that two-year period that was different from the Newark protest approvals. Under the regulation, as clarified by the drafting history, the importer does not need to show that the treatment was actually applied at more than one port as long as there was no different or inconsistent action at a different port. The government has raised three counterarguments, and we submit that all three of those are meritless. First, the government has pointed out that there were entries at Long Beach, but they were bypass liquidations, and the Court of Appeals has ruled the bypass liquidations are to be given no weight whatsoever. And so they cannot be even evaluated as a relevant factor that undermines the national basis requirement.
Well, let's stop right there for a moment, Mr. Reed. I need you to tease that out for me a little bit. We have as a given, Federal Circuit said the court can't consider bypass liquidations, right? Effectively saying there was not the kind of action or determination contemplated by the first prong of the regulation with respect to a bypass liquidation, correct?
Correct.
Is it plaintiff's position that you are interpreting no consideration, no weight, no relevance to the bypass liquidations going all the way through the process? Meaning anything that occurs subsequent to the bypass liquidation is also out of the question. So if there was a protest with respect to the bypass liquidation, the consideration that Customs gave to that protest is equally out because the underlying predicate was out.
Hypothetically speaking, if there had been a bypass liquidation at another port that was protested, and the protest had been acted on, the protest decision would be an actual determination.
It would be a determination or other action by Customs that would be considered
right.
With respect to determining whether there was a claim of treatment that was made.
Right. But
okay.
In this case, that did not happen. The protests were filed at Long Beach with respect to those eight entries, but they were suspended under Customs' own protest suspension procedure. The government has suggested that because they were suspended, that should disqualify the treatment claim, but we respectfully disagree with that. The protest suspension procedure was a long-established procedure by Customs that is designed for the purpose of the orderly administration of the customs law, where an importer has filed a protest and an application for further review at one port, and the customs regulations or the customs practice states that when the importer protests, it should request disposition of the protest at the second port in accordance with the pending protest and application for further review. That is what Kent did, and Long Beach, consistent with that practice, suspended consideration of the Long Beach protests. If the the regulation here, it was drafted well after the protest suspension procedure existed, and if Custis had wished to prevent or to rule that the protest suspension procedure would preclude a treatment claim, it could have provided that in the regulation, but it did not do so. And I add, there is a sort of a catch-22. If protest suspension at one port prevents a treatment claim, well, that would mean that apparently the protest would have to be approved at more than one port, but then the catch-22 is that that can't happen because the protests are suspended at the second port. And so for all of those reasons, we do not see any meritorious objection to the requirement that customs, that the treatment was applied on a national basis. And therefore, in conclusion to my first point, Kent has established that there was a statutorily protected treatment based on its own entries as reflected in the consistent approvals of the protests for a period more than 2 years.
So, Mr. Reed, for the national basis prong of the test to be satisfied, can the activities, must the activities take place at more than one port?
No, I think the drafting history makes that very clear, that they have to look at actual determinations, and if there are not actual determinations at more than one port that are inconsistent, that satisfies the national basis requirement.
Okay.
It is a requirement of lack of national inconsistency, as it is unlike the old uniform and established practice requirement that the decision had to actually have been applied at more than one port. Here, the requirement is no inconsistent action.
Okay. Anything more on your first point, Mr.
No, that concludes the first point. So let me turn to my second point, that the treatment accrued in November of 2010 as a result of the protest approvals, and it became a binding administrative precedent that applies to all of Kent's entries in this case. The regulation, the over a two-year period immediately preceding the claim of treatment, then establishes a requirement that customs must have applied an administrative decision. That here, that is the 9401 classification, must apply that consistently for a period of 2 years for the decision to qualify as a treatment. And since Kent's claim is based on protest approvals, we look to the dates of the protest approvals, and it was in November of 2010 that customs had consistently approved protests for more than 2 years. Then this leads to a more an equally important and perhaps more complex question. Given that the treatment accrued in November 2010, which entries does it benefit? Which entries does it apply to? And there are two positions. Kent's position is that treatment means that there is a binding administrative precedent. And so, like any other binding precedent, it applies to all pending decisions, all pending protests, all pending entries, as well as future entries up to the time that the treatment is revoked. The government takes a different approach, and it says that a treatment is kind of a new cause of action. And so it only applies to new entries that were made after the treatment accrued. Under the government's approach, The government concedes that some two-thirds of the entries in this case were filed after November of 2010, and so even under the government's interpretation, they should be liquidated in accordance with Kent's claim. But let me come back to the choice, new cause of action or administrative precedent. The administrative precedent approach is the correct interpretation. We should look at the purpose of Section 1625. The purpose is to create a binding administrative precedent. Once a customs decision has been consistently applied for a long enough period, that is 2 years, it becomes a binding precedent, and it can only be revoked prospectively and only after the notice and comment proceeding. And the purpose, remember, 1625 covers written ruling letters as well as unwritten administrative decisions. And the purpose of the statute is to put the unwritten administrative decisions on a par with written ruling letters, because decisions against arbitrary changes. The language of the regulation supports Kent's position and not the government's position. The subsection of the regulation is section 1677.12e, and it says that the revocation of a treatment only applies to entries made after the notice of revocation is published.
You said 1677, you mean 177.
Oh, correct. 177. I apologize. 177.12. And so it says that the treatment only applies to entries made after the notice of revocation is published. So that means that everything that happened before that, all of the pending protests, all of the pending entries, any entries made after the treatment accrued, all need to be decided in accordance with the treatment. And the protest suspension procedure leads to the same conclusion. So the idea is that when the Long Beach protests were suspended, pending disposition of the lead protest and application for further review. Once that the Newark protest was decided and it became an administrative precedent, it should apply to the Long Beach protests.
So there's a reach back and a reach forward aspect to your position. The reach back is you look at the date of accrual, right, to see if there was a treatment for the 2 years prior to that date.
Right.
Correct? And the reach forward is it applies to the protests, I'm sorry, applies to the entries covered by the protests relative with respect to that accrual, right? So that's looking back. But it also has a forward effect to any entries until formally revoked through the notice and comment process of 1625.
Right. And on the second part, the looking forward, I don't think the government contests that. The only issue is, does the treatment apply to pending protests against entries that were entered before November of 2010?
So is there a dispute as to the trigger date, the November 10th date, or just the scope of what is covered on the basis of that?
I think that the government takes a slightly different approach. And Kent's approach is that you should look, find when there was a two-year treatment first, and then figure out what that treatment applies to. The government's approach seems to be start with looking at the entry dates and see if there was an administrative, see if there was a treatment that existed at the time the entry was made.
Well, I guess I'm going to have to ask the government about how they square that with the concept of all the operative facts being known with respect to the trigger date, right? Using the, I think it's the language from the American Fiber case. if I remember, and finishing case, if I remember correctly.
Right, American Fiber, yes.
I'm sorry?
American Fiber, that is correct, the case.
Yeah, American Fiber, right. American Fiber and finishing, right.
And that case, we argue, should be applied by analogy, because there, the departure from the treatment was established based on entry liquidations, and the departure from the treatment was in customs treatment of the entries.
Right.
Here we are relying on protest approvals instead of the original liquidations.
Right. And so that's the significant distinction between the facts of this case and American Fiber. One is dealing with approval dates relative to protests, the other one dealing with entries.
Right. And a key point on this applicability, the government has argued that the importer must have relied on treatment in making entries. We respectfully contend that that is incorrect.
I'm sorry, say that again, Mr.
The government, I believe, is arguing that the importer had to have relied on the treatment at the time it made entry. And so...
Right, but... Is reliance part of the test?
No, it's not. Our response is that the government's invocation of the reliance is incorrect, and that is clear from the drafting history of the regulation. There is a reference to reliance, but the complete quotation from the drafting history says that it is intended to give protection against abrupt changes made by customs without prior notice, particularly where a party has reasonably relied.
So putting it in simple terms, what plaintiff is asking for is equivalence.
I did not hear the last part.
No, I said, so in very simple terms, what the plaintiff is looking for is equivalence.
Equivalence between...
In terms of its treatment.
Right.
Right, okay.
Looking for that the treatment should be applied to the entries made before that were subject to pending protests in November of 2010, as well as the future entries. And so that concludes my second point. The treatment accrued in November of 2010, because that was when the seat classification had been applied consistently for more than 2 years in protest approvals, and it became a binding administrative precedent applicable to the pending protests as well as future protests as well as future entries. I turn to my third point. The Customs has also established a treatment based on all importers' entries. Customs applied a consistent treatment of all of child safety seats for bicycles to all importers of similar merchandise for more than 2 years. An important point on the third-party claim is that every other importer importing similar merchandise between 2004 and 2014, other than Kent, if the importer exercised reasonable care, it had a legal obligation to enter child safety seats for bicycles under the seat classification.
Isn't that an assumption? You use the word if they exercised reasonable care, right? I thought the government's point is that there is actually no documentary evidence that demonstrates that actual entries were made pursuant to the three ruling letters issued to Kent's three competitors, and that the plaintiff's argument is, shall we say, a logical extension. If they got the ruling letters, one would presume that they did in fact make entries, but plaintiff has not, to the best of my knowledge, proffered any documentary evidence to demonstrate that.
The evidence from the Todson Company states that they imported...
That's the affidavit, correct? Right. The Todry's affidavit, okay.
That states that Todson did import child safety seats for bicycles during this period, and that they were classified as seats under heading 9401.
But there's some government's raised some question about that affidavit or declaration, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So there's been no definitive determination. There's been no concession by the part of the government and no definitive determination by this court with respect to the efficacy of that declaration, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
But then another point, the Vietnam food companies, they did receive the ruling letters, and they made hundreds of entries at multiple ports, all of which were liquidated under heading 9401. In those hundreds of entries, if there was one child safety seat in one entry, that would be enough to establish Kent's claim. And we think that based on the evidence that's available, that is a reasonable inference. And so that is our the basis for our third-party claim. That, and let me then reiterate, assuming that any other importer of child safety seats exercised reasonable care and actually imported the product, they had a legal obligation to enter it as seats, and that their entries would have been liquidated as seats. They would not have needed to protest, and the revocation of the treatment or the revocation of their rulings only applied prospectively. Now, what Kent is looking for in this litigation is that its entries should be treated in the same way as every other importer of similar merchandise is treated. And so,
okay. Anything else, Mr. Reed?
No, if you have no further questions.
Okay. Court's got a couple of other questions. One of the briefs that you filed earlier this year, plaintiff makes some reference to the court ruling that a particular portion of the customs regulation that disallows consideration of third parties is illegal and void. It's still the plaintiff's position that you're looking for a declaration from this court to void that portion of the regulation?
Well, if the court decides our first theory that Kent's entries alone establish...
let's assume we're beyond that, so, and we're into the third party.
Then if we get to the third parties.
Right.
Well, there is this provision of the regulation that seems to say that third party entries cannot be considered. And in the California industrial case, the Court of Appeals ruled that that interpretation is contrary to the statute, so the interpretation is invalid. However, in that case, the entries were made before the regulation took effect, so that the regulation itself was not before the court, but the government invoked the administrative interpretation that was reflected in the regulation. Therefore, the regulation appears to be valid thus far, but the government agrees that third-party entries can appropriately be considered under the California industrial case.
Right, but the regulation is the agency's interpretation of the statute or the agency's effort to fill in gaps or deal with vagueness that exists in the statute, correct?
Right.
Right. It's an interpretation. The Court of Appeals has come along and looked at the statute and rendered a different interpretation.
Right.
So California Industrial governs in plaintiff's view, correct?
Yes, it does. And I...
Does that then require that I have to declare the regulation void? Or can I just... Right. I'm trying to figure out how to get to the end here. Right. So do I have to declare the regulation void, or do I just follow Federal Circuit precedent and say third-party actions are relevant and may be considered?
Well, since we are in a constant energy crisis, perhaps the most efficient energy-saving technique would be simply to follow California industry.
Okay. All right. Next item. Mr. Reed, you referred to the mandate rule of banks in one of your briefs. And under the mandate rule, a court must adhere to a matter decided in a prior appeal unless one of the three exceptional circumstances exist. And the rule is limited to issues actually decided either explicitly or by necessary implication in the previous litigation. Can you help the court understand what is it that the mandate rule requires of this court, particularly as a result of the Federal Circuit's decision in Kent 5?
The mandate rule requires this court to give no weight whatsoever to the bypass entries at Long Beach.
Okay, but in one of your briefs, you say that the government is attempting to skirt the mandate rule. And I'm assuming by that you are talking about the portion of the government's brief where they are, I think in using your words, there's this question of relevance or irrelevance with respect to the Long Beach entries, the bypass entries.
That's correct. We read the government's brief to say that the Long Beach entries are relevant, even though they can be given no consideration whatsoever, no weight whatsoever. And
right. But what I'm trying to understand is, are you saying that the government is skirting the mandate rule and that the bank's case binds the agency to do, requires the agency to do something, or are you saying that you, court, in considering what the agency did, you are bound by what the Federal Circuit did and you have to ignore the bypass entry?
Right. I think we are saying that you, Your Honor, and this court need to follow the Court of Appeals mandate.
Okay.
And give no weight whatsoever to the Long Beach entries. And we understood the position of the government's brief to say that the Long Beach entries are a factor that is still irrelevant and should be considered, and we think that is inconsistent with the Court of Appeals decision.
Okay. All right. In a related vein, Mr. Reed, in addition to the fact that Long Beach Customs entries were liquidated as bypass, is this court required to ignore, as it's been instructed in Kent 5 by the Federal Circuit with respect to the bypass entries, is it required to ignore the indication by Long Beach Customs of that port's intention to deny Kent's protest, notwithstanding Kent's request that a decision on its Long Beach protest be stayed pending consideration of the AFR filed through Newark Customs?
I think that the statement of intention by the customs official is not a customs action.
Not an action. Does not rise to satisfying the first prong of the test.
Right.
Okay. And has nothing to do with the Court of Appeals instruction to ignore.
Right.
Okay. Very good. One moment, please. Let me check one other thing. Okay, hold on one second. Mr. Reed, thank you for your presentation. The court has no further questions.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Triana, do we need a 2 or 3 minute stretch break, or are you prepared to proceed?
I'm prepared if you are.
I'm prepared. Let us go.
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Ms. Triana.
I just wanted to excuse me. I just wanted to address one point right off the bat. With respect to whether we're following the mandate of the Federal Circuit, what the Federal Circuit said was we couldn't consider the bypass liquidations because they were, in fact, bypass liquidations that can't be considered in a treatment analysis. The issue before the Federal Circuit was the previous decision by this court, which said that basically those bypass liquidations negated a treatment of 9401, and the holding was that it couldn't do that. But we're not arguing that the court should consider the liquidation in heading 8714. Instead, we're just asking this court to consider the fact that entries of plaintiff's merchandise were coming in more than one port of entry, in two ports of entry, and basically we're operating on parallel tracks, obviously with the Port of Newark a little earlier on in the track, but there was entries made of the same merchandise in both ports of entry. They were all entered in 8714. They were all liquidated by bypass entry in both ports, is my understanding. But we're looking at the protests, and yes, we're looking at the protests in Newark, but we were just noting the fact that entries are made, merchandise is coming in two ports of entry, and essentially actions classifying in 9401 were only happening at one port of entry. So that was our purpose in bringing up them, not to say that the fact that they liquidated in 8714 by bypass should on its own negate treatment. That was what the issue was going to the Federal Circuit, and that was the decision that came down from the Federal Circuit. We were in no way, shape, or form trying to skirt what the Federal Circuit said. We're not arguing that the liquidation in 8714 is the relevant issue. We were identifying the fact that there are entries in more than one port of entry. There are protests almost identical in more than one port of entry, and only one port of entry made a determination that classification in 9401 was proper.
Well, the court appreciates your explanation, Ms. Triana. Just take a deep breath, relax. There's no stress here, all right?
So Kent cannot establish the existence of a treatment of classifying its child bicycle seats in 9401 even without considering the bypass liquidation. A treatment claim requires consistency in classification on a national basis, and those facts don't exist here. We already are aware in 2005 there was a ruling issued classifying the merchandise in 8714. And then again, there were entries made in protests filed at two separate ports of entry, but only a single port of entry classified the merchandise in 9401. At the Port of New York.
That's a nice statement, Ms. Triana, but let's also be realistic that, you know, at least as I understand the facts, only one port acted. The other port was asked to stand, right, still pending the AFR that was filed at the initial port that was doing all of the actions. So, you know, your statement's somewhat overbroad here, and I appreciate the government's litigating position, but
actions were only taken at a single port of entry.
That's correct. Actions were only taken at a single port. So the question is, in much the same way I asked it to Mr. Reed, is that enough, right? Must there be actions at multiple ports in order to obtain a national treatment?
I don't know that that's a clear answer one way or the other. I think that it would depend on the facts of that case. The regulation requires you to look at this on a case-by-case basis. So if, for example, you have an importer that imports...
Well, let's look at it in this case, Ms. Triana. We got, you know, there really are only two fact patterns, right? All entries occur at one port, which I asked, you know, Mr. Reed that question, and he seemed to indicate that whatever the actions were that were taken there, that could be sufficient to demonstrate a national basis for the claim of treatment. I'm assuming you agree.
I think if all entries...
No, just answer my question, Ms. Triana. If the entries, I'm giving you a hypothetical, if all the entries occur at one port and that port is taking the actions, is that sufficient to create, to be a national basis for a claim of treatment?
In a hypothetical scenario,
yes,
right. In a hypothetical scenario, right. I would say there would be a strong case for it. I think there would be a strong case for it if all entries were made at one port of entry. What an importer
to do. Okay, so now we're gonna slightly change the facts, and there's entries made at two ports, but only one port is acting, and the other port is standing down in accordance with a well-established procedure in customs. What's the difference? One port is acting. All of the decisions that are being made at one port. The other port is not acting. It is staying any consideration until all of the activity that needs to be done is taken at that other port. Why is that not enough?
In those facts, all an importer who is getting in a favorable decision at one port would have to do is ask all other ports to stand down until a two-year period had gone by, and it shouldn't be in the importer's...
Right, but that's within customs discretion to do it or not do it. If customs doesn't want to stand down, right, it doesn't have to, but it chose to, right? You can't put this all on the importer. The importer has done what it needed to do in accordance with existing customs procedures. Customs exercised discretion and chose not to act, waiting in abeyance for decisions to be made at the Port of Newark. Correct?
That is what happened, Your
Honor. Right. So the question is, why isn't that enough?
I think considering all relevant factors, and it's not just those actions that have to be considered. It's
okay,
all relevant
what other
factors?
I think considering all other relevant factors, what are they, Ms. Cranley?
I think the relevant factors is this importer was, you had essentially parallel tracks where the importer was importing merchandise at two ports of entry, and only one port of entry was making these determinations, and this had to be on a national basis. And like you said, in the hypothetical, if they're only ever importing at one port of entry, you know, you can't ask for something to be applied on a national basis when it's only one port of entry. But here, that's
not
the
case. Why not? Right? If it's one port of entry and they're the only ones acting, why isn't that enough? Considering everything else, right? Assume everything else is totally neutral, right? Why isn't that enough? Right? The purpose behind the regulations language is to prevent, right, a sudden change in position that creates inconsistency. Here, it seems to me that the invocation of the suspension process is actually to promote the exact opposite, making sure that there is consistency across the board, waiting for another port who apparently has chosen to take the lead, perhaps in consultation with the Office of National Import Specialists, right, to promote that consistency. What's wrong with that?
Nothing is wrong with that, but in this case, immediately after the protest approvals, the Port of Long Beach indicated that they did not intend to follow what the Port of Newark did, and they intended to follow the binding ruling which the Port of Newark should have followed.
Is that a determination that satisfies the first prong of the test?
That's not an actual determination.
Right. So then didn't the Port of Long Beach have an opportunity to take an action or make a determination that would satisfy the first prong of the test? Right. Okay. Intentions are one thing. Actions are something else. And the law speaks to actions, not intentions.
My understanding is what happened at the Port of Long Beach, and obviously plaintiffs can correct me if I'm not accurately stating this, is that they were informed that the Port of Long Beach intended to deny the protest, and they thereafter filed another application for further review with Long Beach, which is the application that was eventually denied in 2015. Just to make another point going back to, because there's been reference to what the purpose of the treatment statute, and according to the Federal Register...
Take a deep breath, Ms. Triana. I'm not trying to... overwhelming here. Just take a deep breath, pace yourself through, right? We got plenty of time.
In the implicit in the MOD Act statutory changes was the idea that a reasonable expectation was created by the actions of customs and they were entitled to some protection. There was no consistency in what happened here. And that's the primary reason that this is not entitled to treatment. They had no expectation interest. I'm not saying that's an element. We didn't argue that, and I don't believe that's the case. Reasonable reliance is part of the statutory language that importers should be able to reasonably rely on customs, and that's why a 60-day period was built in as far as the notice and comment and when it actually applies. If you look at the facts of this case, there was no reasonable reliance on anything. We have a ruling in 8714. We have an importer who almost entirely throughout always entered into
merchandise. Well, let's stop right there. Hold on 1 second, Ms. Triana. And there, we may need to create a distinction here.
Okay.
There's no reasonable reliance with respect to Kent as the importer, with respect in light of its own transactions? Or are you saying no reasonable reliance with respect to any transaction, which could include third parties? How are you splitting? Right?
Well, I wasn't
you,
sure.
You're talking about reasonable reliance. Reasonable reliance based on what? Focused on what?
Primarily, the ruling that they was issued to them. So we could. I'm
okay.
Setting aside the rulings that are issued
right,
to third parties.
But what's in dispute is that ruling is over here, and there now seems to be, resource, if I understand this case, right, actions taken or determinations taken by customs with respect to Kent's own transactions that are running contrary to that ruling.
That is
correct?
Accurate, yes.
All right.
And,
Kent would be in trouble with customs if it didn't enter that merchandise in the first instance in accordance with the 2005 ruling, right? They would be violative of the standard of reasonable care. Correct?
They would, and I want to say, we are not asserting or alleging that the plaintiff did anything wrong.
No, I got it, okay? So plaintiff comes along, it's behaving itself by entering the merchandise in accordance with the ruling.
Yes.
It lodges a protest, and the protest is granted, giving it an outcome that it now wants contrary to the ruling, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Plaintiff importer continues to file protests, right, with a expectation that something's going on here that's contrary to the ruling and is looking for that contrary outcome, which appears to be being satisfied, correct?
That's correct.
Right. Given that circumstance, why isn't plaintiff allowed to reasonably rely upon the fact in unwritten ruling letters, right, that customs has now changed its mind?
Because they don't have a ruling that – they don't have anything – their ruling letter is still in place, and they are still required –
Yeah, but customs has changed its mind, Ms. Triana, even though it's at one port. Customs has changed its mind.
I wouldn't say customs has changed its mind. I would say that one port incorrectly did not follow a binding ruling letter.
On its own or without any input from the Office of National Import Specialists?
That I can't say who specifically, although I will agree we don't challenge that the decision was made by people that are entitled to make that decision. I think that just seven.
Okay. So then.
But they made the wrong.
Ms. Triana, right? It's my hearing, okay? I'm going to give you plenty of time to make your points. What is it that you believe plaintiff should have done in order to, at that point, it's got protests that are being acted on, they're being granted, it appears, right, that there may be input from higher ups than beyond the port. What do you want the plaintiff to do? What are they supposed to do? They're supposed to, right? They filed an AFR. They're looking for another ruling. What more do you want them to do?
I don't think it's our position that we think the plaintiff should have done more or that they should have done something different. Our position is the facts here aren't treatment. Now, they got the ruling, they got the decision they wanted. Frankly, they got a windfall out of Newark because, as the court knows, that was the wrong classification. They got a windfall for however many entries came in through Newark. It was the wrong decision. I'm not saying they didn't have the authority to make that decision, but
no,
they made
it. No, it was a decision that was contrary to the ruling.
Yes, and contrary to this court's decision.
No, I understand, but at the time, you know, I'm not quite sure one could characterize it as the wrong ruling, right?
Well,
it was a ruling contrary to the 2005 ruling letter. Yes, the consequence of it is they got a windfall. I agree.
They got a windfall, and what they're coming to this court and asking is, I want to get that same windfall.
I want more of a windfall for my entries.
And yes,
exactly. That occurred roughly at the same time. And the government is saying they're not entitled to the windfall.
They're not entitled to that additional windfall.
Okay.
And I don't think they had a reasonable expectation, not saying they did anything wrong, but they didn't have a reasonable expectation that they're going to, essentially their treatment is, I'm going to enter in 8714 and expect that their protests are going to be approved at the Port of Newark. That's not a treatment claim. Now, this is an unusual procedural posture for a treatment claim where the treatment they're asking for is what Customs did in by way of a protest. So I think that is probably why everything's not analogous. It's hard to analyze these facts. They're not analogous to anything, and they're very unusual.
Well, thank you for that concession.
So, but at the same time, what we're looking for is consistency and an ability to rely on what has happened with Customs, and certainly there was no expectation of that their classification was going to be in 9401. We had two time periods that this happened. This happened on two dates in 2008, and then it happened in 2010. There was no consistent national application of these rulings. Long Beach was well aware, I'm sure, of these rulings, and that is why they made notification right after.
So are you suggesting that there has to be a pattern or a continuous stream for that consistency to exist?
Definitely not.
Okay.
What I'm suggesting is there was probably a consistent stream of imports coming in from this importer, and everything has to be considered as a whole. This is not a situation where you have only one there were a lot of factors to consider, mostly that there are entries made at more than one port and there isn't consistency throughout this. I understand that you don't consider decisions on rulings in a treatment analysis. We discuss it more to bring context to this whole fact pattern. What we have here is essentially one port made a decision incorrectly.
So, that view, that statement is through the set of lenses when we're looking at Kent's entries alone, correct? Being responsive to the plaintiff's first line of argument.
Yes.
Okay. Is that statement true if the plaintiff fails on the first line of argument and we go to the plaintiff's third line of argument, which is third parties? Then we have more ports, correct? And we have other ports making determinations that seem to line up with the plaintiff's position of how the merchandise should be classified.
When you're considering, there is no evidence of treatment when you consider third-party entries. There is no evidence of entries of child bicycle seats made by any other importer.
There's no evidence in this case but for the Totson Declaration.
The Totson Declaration, as we argued in the initial summary judgment briefing, should not be considered here.
Okay.
We were never made aware of Mr. Totson, and the declaration was signed before discovery closed, and I was never made aware of this person's name.
Okay.
On top of that, if you read the declaration, it's not clear that they went back and looked at any entries and said, these are child bicycle seats. And thirdly, even if they were, there's no evidence that anybody at Customs ever looked at these entries, that they weren't just bypass entries that shouldn't be considered.
So we got a factual problem, is what you're saying, if we venture into the third-party argument.
I would say there is no evidence of it.
Okay.
So there is no evidence that it's not our position that you can't ever consider a third party entry in a treatment claim. I'm sure that was something, I know that was something that you discussed with plaintiff's counsel. But it is our position that there's no evidence on this record. And I don't believe there's any evidence that either the government has or even plaintiff has that could support this. That would have to be something as far as entries made by that probably the third parties would only have, certainly with respect to whether they had any interaction with Customs as to what this merchandise was.
I appreciate the clarification.
Your Honor, can I just take 1 minute?
You can take two.
Thank you.
I just wanted to clarify one factual point that I didn't earlier.
You may.
So we discussed whether the Port of Long Beach was essentially waiting on a decision from the Port of Newark, and that's why they waited. It's been clarified that they were not waiting on the Port of Newark. They were waiting on headquarters, who they assumed would be making a decision in the AFR, which is what should have happened had the port sent the AFR to headquarters where they would have considered the 2005 ruling, but that never happened. So it wasn't that they were waiting on or deferring in any way to the Port of Newark on that classification determination.
So there was a breakdown in process? The AFR never got to headquarters?
Well, the facts of this, the AFRs, neither AFR was ever decided. So because the port approved it, it never was decided by headquarters.
So if the process hadn't broken down, we might not even be here today, because somebody would have rendered a decision and the case would be in a completely different posture.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
maybe there's a lesson to be learned here that will enable the process to be improved. Continue, Ms. Triana.
I just want to point out one other. The regulation, which is 19 CFR 177.12 and then C.1.2 or II, it does provide some additional guidance beyond the three prongs. And I did mention this earlier, but the determination of whether the requisite treatment occurred will be made by Customs on a case-by-case basis involving all relevant factors, not necessarily just actual determinations that were made. And that's part of the regulation, which was adopted by the...
Talk about that for a moment.
Okay.
So in the brief, you acknowledge the court can't consider the Long Beach entries liquidated under heading 8714 because they occurred through the bypass procedure. Yet you maintain the court can still consider the existence of these entries as the provision in the regulation that you just recited provides for consideration of, quote, all relevant factors. Is this really a tenable position given the Federal Circuit's guidance in Kent 5?
Yes, because we're not asking the court to consider the fact that they were liquidated in 8714. I was asking the court to consider the fact that they exist, that this is not a situation where the importer only imports at the Port of Newark and got all favorable decisions in the only place it imported. And I think those would be different facts and maybe a different decision. What we have here, like you already summarized earlier.
So you're asking the court under 177.12(c)(i) to take note that there were entries at the Port of Long Beach.
Not just entries, but really more importantly, there were protests that were filed.
Right. Entries from which protests flowed, right? And ignore the fact that they were liquidated via the bypass entry process. By the bypass liquidation process.
It's not really relevant to what we're, I mean, they are facts. I mean, it was.
Right. You're asking me to take note that these entries existed and that they were protested and to ignore in concert with what the Federal Circuit's instruction was in Kent 5 to not give those liquidations any import with respect to the first part of the prong, which is determinations.
Yeah, or in addition to they're not even the third part, they're not an application
right.
of any determination.
Right. Okay.
So right. just to consider the fact that they exist, that this is a more complex fact pattern than we imported in Newark. They gave us a favorable decision over 2 years. That should be applied everywhere else because that's what they're asking. This is a one decision. Should this be applied in every other port of entry? There are other ports that were, I think it was imported at, just not during this relevant time period.
Okay, so let me ask you a couple of follow-ups. So you also acknowledge that the only actual determinations made between August 8 and November 10 occurred at the Port of Newark, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Assuming that the court cannot consider the Long Beach entries or the liquidations on those entries at all, is it still the government's position that Kent cannot demonstrate that its entries were afforded a treatment on a national basis? I'm assuming I know the answer to that question.
I mean, yes, that's our position that they can't,
right. yes. Okay. So, therefore, is it your position that an importer cannot claim a treatment where it only has entries at a single port? And we had touched on this earlier, and I think I know the answer.
Yeah. I don't think that's our position. I think we haven't fully analyze that because those aren't the facts of this case, but there would be a strong, much stronger case for treatment if they only ever entered merchandise at one port and they were getting a favorable decision at that port.
Okay, good. All right. Let me just check one other thing here. Okay, you may continue, Ms. Triana.
Unless the court has any other questions on that first point, I'm going to move on to the time period point.
Sure, move on to the time period. That's perfectly fine.
I think that the parties do agree on some facts. If the court were to find that there was a treatment, which we don't think there was, but if the court were to find that there was a treatment, it would apply to entries that were made after the treatment accrued, so after November of 2010. So this argument that I'm going to make now is really only relevant to, and I could be wrong, but about 15 entries.
I'm sorry, repeat that last point.
So this argument, this time period argument,
right.
would only really be relevant to about 15 entries because most of the entries, I think there's 45 in this case, most of them came in after what plaintiffs contend was the two-year period of treatment. So for those...
So let me see if I can parse this.
Okay.
Right. Assuming for the sake of argument, the court finds a treatment, the parties appear to be in agreement that the trigger date is November 2010, right? That protest, that was correct?
I believe so.
Right.
Yes.
And the dispute is if we have a universe of 45 entries, the plaintiff's position is if they win, it covers all 45 entries for the reasons that they've proffered.
Yes.
The government's position is it doesn't apply to all 45 entries. It applies to 31 entries or 30 entries or 15 entries?
30. It would apply to the 30, not okay. The 15, yes.
Okay.
I don't know if it's 30 or 31. I could be wrong.
But it's in that range, right?
Yes.
Two-thirds in, one-third out. Okay.
Yes.
Go ahead.
So the plaintiff can't, our position is the plaintiff can't claim relief under 1625C2 for entries that are made before a cause of action for treatment ever accrues. So if you look at the regulation, you have to look at the two-year period immediately preceding the claim of treatment. So the question is, what is the claim of treatment, and how do you date that claim of treatment? And American Fiber and Finishing addresses this issue. They talk about what constitutes a claim of treatment.
Does American Fiber and Finishing address this issue in the sense that it is informative, instructive, or something more? Right? Because American Fiber and Finishing deals with entries, not protests, and a trigger date. And I think you said earlier that, you know, not everything is on all fours here, so we're dealing with a lot of things perhaps by analogy.
We are dealing with by analogy, but in this case, we're talking about when a cause of action accrues and whether you can apply, you can grant relief to entries that came in before the cause of action ever accrued. And this case talks about what is a claim in generally, and then right. What's a claim of treatment. So it's a claim is the aggregate of facts that give rise to a right that's enforceable by the court. And a claim of treatment, the facts that give rise to an enforceable treatment claim. And to have an enforceable treatment claim, you need to have a two-year consistent pattern of action in order to make a claim of treatment based on an entry. So if you have an entry that came in 2009, you have no enforceable right to a treatment that did not accrue yet.
So I need some help here, Ms. Tran, because
okay.
I'm thinking about potentially how I have to write this and explain this to both sides and to the world, okay? So it seems to me that we have agreement, assuming that the court finds that there's a treatment, that the trigger date is November 2010. And as I went through this with Mr. Reed, there's a reach back and a reach forward, right? So the reach back, starting with November 2010, if I understand this correctly, is I look 2 years back, right, to see if there's a consistent treatment, correct?
If you're considering actions taken between 2008 and 2010, that is your 2 years. So, but when you're looking at an entry, you have to look at when that entry came in.
Right, but that's where I'm getting. So
yes.
Just stay with me.
Okay.
I'm starting with November 2010, and I'm reaching back 24 months.
Yes.
Okay. Assuming that there were protests filed in that period, or the protest, which is the trigger date, covered entries, right? Are you saying to me, let me ask it this way. Are you saying to me if there are entries in that protest that are prior, that occurred prior to the 24-month reach back, that I can't consider them?
Yes.
Okay.
Because at that point, there was no cause of action. So if you think of it this way, every entry could be a separate cause of action, right? We could have come to court on every one. So
right.
If they came to court on only the first entry, which came in I think, December of 2008.
Correct.
They have no cause of action for treatment on that entry. How could they? There was only one approval that happened 4 months ago. So I use that as when I said that the time period is wrong. It's wrong if you're considering the first entry. So you have to look at the date. So there could be a separate analysis.
But if the entry gave rise to the protest, which is the operative trigger event for the claim of treatment, why isn't that entry swept up into that, right, into that claim?
Because you have no cause of action. You would have no cause of action for treatment based on that entry. there was no two-year period of a consistent pattern of any action in December of 2008. You can't be relying on a prior treatment.
So I have an entry that gives rise to the protest. The protest says there is a claim of treatment because Customs behaved a certain way for the prior 2 years, right? But you're, so the question is, at what point prior, how, now you've lost me to a certain extent, Ms. Triana, because you can't file a protest unless you have entries, right, with which you are dissatisfied with the action of CBP. So are you saying to me that even though the entry is underlying the claim, that I can't, that we can't reach those entries?
That I, if I'm following you, Your Honor, that is what I'm saying. So,
so at what point, right, are entries in or entries out?
They have to have been entered or, I guess, removed from the warehouse when, after there was a claim of treatment, because it was only after there was a claim of treatment, a two-year pattern, that there's any reasonable expectation of a certain classification. When these protests were made, by the way, in 2009 and 2010, there was no treatment claim for them. They made a treatment, they amended their protests in like, I could be wrong about the date, 2014, to claim treatment, because when they made a protest in 2009, they had no expectation of a two-year pattern of a consistent classification in heading 9401, because at that point, there was only one action that was ever taken, or two actions.
Which was the 2005 one.
No, no, it was the 2008, there was 2008.
2008 classification.
Right. So at that point, when they entered it in 2009, all they know is I have, there was two rulings, there was two protest approvals in 2008. That's not a treatment.
I got it. Okay. I understand. Okay. I got it. Thank you. Okay.
So, again, if a cause of action hadn't accrued at the time of entry, if there had not been a two-year pattern of consistent action classifying merchandise in 9401, there can't be a claim of treatment as to that entry. And every entry, it would be a different, I mean, I don't want to say a different analysis. I think there's a hard line here of when you hit 2 years, if the court finds treatment, it can apply to entries after that date, which here.
So it's entries after the date on which the court finds that there was a treatment. Entries before that are out because they could not have been subject to the claim of treatment at the time that they were protesting.
Exactly. No, at the time they were.
At the time entry. Of entry. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, some of them, the protest was filed in this period,
right.
Too,
oh, okay.
But I don't know that that's
right.
The relevant nope. Part. I think we've covered that point. And honestly, I think we've covered the third-party entries as well. But I'm happy to answer any additional questions on that point. I mean, Kent has to prove, in order to make a treatment claim based on third-party entries, that the duty-free rate accorded to other child bicycle seats resulted from actual determinations that was consistently applied. And that evidence just doesn't exist on this record.
Okay. Hold on 1 second. Ms. Triana, on your last point, there were protests that were suspended. Consideration of those protests were suspended. Does that suspension have any impact on the accrual date and which entries are swept in and which entries are not?
If I understand, I don't. Are we going, we're going back to the time period question?
Yes.
I don't think so, because it's not the protests themselves, but the entry dates that's relevant here. So whether or not there were protests
Right, but the trigger is based upon the trigger is based upon an action by Customs on the protest that yields a determination, correct?
That's what plaintiff's treatment claim is based on, actions approving protest, yes. But I still go back to the same point. You have to have a cause of action for an entry to make a claim of treatment. There has to be a treatment before you make entry on, otherwise you have no expectation of it.
So let's frame it this way. You're saying the predicate condition has to exist for the claim with respect to that entry to exist.
Exactly.
Okay. Very good. Okay, we're going to take a five-minute break. We're going to let you all stretch your legs. Mr. Reed will give you an opportunity to rebut for a few minutes, and Ms. Triana, if you feel that you need to do a sir rebuttal, I'll give you a few moments for that, but we're going to take a five-minute stretch break.
Thank you.
Court is in recess. 5 minutes. Sam, please pause the stream.
The conference room, which is that chairs.
All right, what time is that one?
No, I usually eat. And sometimes I'm not hungry. I'm not that hungry. And then, like,
you can't do it.
Either no dinner or light dinner.
And you do like the
light dinner. I've never done
that.
All right.
Okay, we are back on the record.
Mr. Reed, do you have anything else that you would like to bring to the court's attention? You may proceed, Mr. Reed.
First, I would like to clarify the record about the suspension of the protests in Long Beach and the processing of the protests in Newark. And this is may not be of great importance, but it goes to the issue of whether the Newark decisions or the mistaken action of a rogue port taken without knowledge or intervention by any other authorities. What happened was that back in 2007, Kent had realized that there was a kind of irregularity, that there was a 2005 ruling, and then their first protest had been approved. And so Kent filed a further protest and an application for further review, meaning further review by Customs Headquarters, filed at Newark. And the Long Beach protests were suspended under that protest and application for further review. So at the time, Kent expected that there would be a decision by Customs Headquarters. Ultimately, in fall of 2010, Customs
This is the first Newark AFR, correct?
Technically, there was a first Newark AFR that, for technical reasons, was dismissed. So there was a second. This is the second.
This is the 2007 AFR?
Yes. Okay. Let me check the dates. I think this was a 2008.
Ms. Triana, Ms. Slapak, can you confirm here?
There were two AFRs, and I don't know. I can't tell you the dates they were filed, although I could probably find it. I'm not here.
But it's the second AFR we're talking about.
So the second AFR was never, neither of the AFRs were decided, the first or the second. The second AFR, it wasn't decided, and then the protests were approved in 2010. So it was probably filed after the first set of protests were approved in 2008, but before 2010.
Excuse me for interrupting. That is the point I would like to clarify.
Okay. All right.
So we're talking about the second Newark AFR.
Okay.
In the fall of 2010, this was before the second AFR was before Customs Headquarters. Customs Headquarters looked at it and said, there's no dispute between the importer and the port. They both agree that the seat classification is correct. And so the AFR was, it was not acted on. Basically, Customs said, there's no dispute, there's no case or controversy. Why should Headquarters decide it? And so it was in that context that then Newark was also waiting for Customs Headquarters to decide. It didn't decide, and given the lack of objection by Customs Headquarters that was aware of the issue, Newark went ahead and approved a bunch of protests in...
Okay, so let me roll this back just to make sure I got our sequencing correct. So there's some activity in 2007... gives rise to an initial AFR.
Right.
Right. Then there's some other activity which gives rise to a second AFR, which it might be slightly murky, could be late 2007, 2008. Correct?
My notes say that the second one was filed in late 2008. The first
late 2008. Okay. Right. And then it took until 2007.
So then the AFR, then Customs HQ looked at it, and in 2010 said, the importer and the port are in agreement. There's nothing for us to decide, and they issued no decision.
Right.
So it's somewhere in a 13, 14-month to 24-month range when nothing happened.
Right.
Okay. Okay.
And so that was the context. Customs, based on Kent's customs attorney's conversations with the parties, the port conferred with the national import specialists, and customs headquarters knew that there was an issue of an inconsistency between the 2005 ruling and the protest approvals, but customs headquarters decided not to intervene or issue any decision.
So we get to 2010. HQ says
nothing.
No case or controversy. Then subsequent protests that had been filed after the AFR, after the 2008 AFR request was made, those protests were approved.
Right.
In light of the no comment by HQ.
Right.
Okay. So post 2008 AFR protests approved. Okay. Got it.
And then we switch the scene to Long Beach, where protests have been filed, but they were suspended in the protest section pending also the decision on the AFR that never was issued.
Timeline, protests 2007, 2008, 2009.
I would have to check the dates, but the protests filed at the appropriate time after the automatic liquidation of the entries. So they, let's see, the entries began in December of 2008. They would have been bypass liquidated in like November of 2009. So these were protests that would have been filed in late 2009, 2010.
Okay. Keep going, Mr.
And so the import specialists, the customs officials at Long Beach, had not even started to look at those protests until after all of the Newark protests were approved, which was after 2010, after November of 2010.
That's very helpful. Thank you, Mr. Reed.
You're welcome. And then my second point is turns to the what is the 2-year period, and the what Your Honor described as reaching back versus reaching forward. And I think Ms. Trana's argument made it very clear. The government is looking at this treatment as a new cause of action that only applies to entries filed after that date. Kent's position is that a treatment is not a cause of action. It is an administrative precedent. It becomes binding when it accrues in November of 2010. And again, the reason we think that the viewing it as a binding precedent is the correct view is that 1625 was enacted in the context of protecting importers against abrupt changes. It dealt not only with unwritten decisions, namely treatment, but also written ruling letters. And the objective was to put those two on an equal status. And so since the ruling letter is binding precedent, it wanted to have administrative decisions that were unwritten, the administrative precedents as well, all of which would remain in effect for everything that was pending, regardless of the entry date, up until it is the ruling or the treatment is revoked revoked prospectively.
So the triggering, so in the way that I was colloquying with Ms. Triana, plaintiff's position is if there were entries that gave rise to the protest, those entries are reachable.
That's
under
correct.
Plaintiff's theory.
Because they were still pending and undecided at the time that the
okay.
administrative precedent became binding.
Anything more, Mr. Reed?
No, nothing further, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Reed. Appreciate it. Ms. Triana?
One thing, Your Honor. The facts, you were asking a lot about the date and the filing of the protest. The facts are laid out in our original brief, not
right.
this one that we just filed. But one other point on the AFR, my understanding, and I don't have the reg number here, is that HQ isn't permitted to decide the AFR if there is an approved protest. If there's an agreement with the port and the importer on the protest, it doesn't get to headquarters. So it's not that they looked at it, said, oh, there's a 2005 ruling that's inconsistent, we need to take this up. My understanding, and if you would like, we could try to find the reg number, is that headquarters doesn't take it up or can't take it up unless there, when there's agreement.
Okay. I got it. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. The court thanks both parties for their presentation and their willingness to engage in a colloquy with the court, and it was very informative. And the court wishes you all a safe and joyous holiday. Try to stay healthy. If you're traveling someplace, please go and return safely. And we will see you after the first of the year. Thank you all very much for your input and participation today.
Thank you.
And no reason to get up. Jason, you can.
Okay. Court is adjourned. Sam, we are done.